conversation?
I do. I'm sitting at my home computer in my bedroom. The kids are downstairs watching TV. I just got the door closed. I have to bring both the cordless phones up here so nobody forgets and tries to call their friends in the middle of the show. I had that happen once.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Rich says hello.
Oh,
be sure.
Say hi back.
I will. We're going down to Ithaca this weekend, too, to see Peter.
Yeah, there's some kind of a deal about the film.
Yeah, well, Larry Lanzman is coming up with
his that's right.
And, you know, so we said, well, gee, since Larry and Peter are going to be there, we're not that far away, so we're going to step down and visit, too.
Good, yeah. What's Larry doing? Does he have a new job?
I don't know yet. I haven't heard. I haven't spoken with him since, like, Roswell last year, I think.
Mm. That's right. Well, the world is changing.
Yeah.
Have we heard anything back from was Peter making a pitch to
Well, I think they were I think the plan is to have Larry make a pitch.
Oh.
I think that's what they want to talk to him about this weekend.
Oh, okay. I still haven't watched the DVD. I should, but
well, I watched the one that we got and it was good. But I think they also have new ones. And apparently we are live. Oh my goodness. I never heard any intro music. Okay.
Nope.
So we will just jump right in because apparently we're already chatting live on the air.
Okay.
Welcome to Through the Keyhole, everyone. And you get to hear a little private conversation here between my guest tonight, Stan Friedman, UFO researcher, nuclear physicist, and I want to talk a little bit about that and about your background, Stan.
Okay. You want me to give you the quick pitch where I'm coming from.
Sure.
Besides Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, capital of the picture province of New Brunswick, where it was 30 below this morning. Oh, boy.
Oh. I don't know if our listeners got to hear that part of our conversation, but we were comparing notes on, you know, who lives in a colder place. And I think for the first time, I got someone who beat me. You're farther north than I am. Usually I talk with people who are in the Southwest or out in California.
Yeah. Fredericton is about the same level as Duluth, Minnesota, something like that. A great place to live. Anyway, background, I grew up in New Jersey. Spent 2 years at Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And then 3 years at the University of Chicago. Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years, same classes. And then I got my master's degree after a bachelor's and went to work in industry. And had set a record for working on more canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs than anybody I've met.
Wow.
Nuclear airplanes for General Electric, compact reactors for space applications for Urjet, General Nucleonics, and fusion rockets. From there to General Motors on a portable nuclear power plant in Indianapolis, and then Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab in Pittsburgh. We built nuclear rocket engines and tested them before the program was canceled. And then briefly with McDonnell Douglas on the ideal job, I thought I was going to be working on trying to back-engineer UFOs. And as I was driving across the country, the program that was sponsoring that work was canceled. I walked in and showed my offer letter, and she says, you know, we just laid off 5,000 people. And I said, yeah, I know. They kept me for 3 weeks, 3 months. It was fun. Then I worked for TRW Systems briefly on the Pioneer spacecraft. Radiation is my bag, radiation shielding and stuff. And the Pioneer was using a radioisotope thermoelectric generator to provide the power. That's a deep space probe. And it's hard to use solar because as you get further from the sun, the intensity decreases. And they wanted to make sure that the radiation instruments on board for detecting space, radiation in space, were not just seeing the radiation coming from the radioisotope thermoelectric generator. So I ran some experiments, and it was fun. And then that ran out. And since then, I've been independent, one might say, lecturing, writing, doing consulting work on a wide variety of interesting things, And I've given something over 700 lectures on flying saucers are real in all 50 states, 9 provinces of Canada, and 16 other countries.
Now, how did you go from working with nuclear power and having all these high security clearances to talking and writing about UFOs?
Well, it was very straightforward. Everybody does.
No, not everybody does.
Well, you know, I got interested in 1958. I was working as a nuclear physicist on nuclear airplanes for General Electric just outside Cincinnati. It was a big program. We were spending $100 million that year in 58, which was a lot of money for then. 3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. And I needed a book. I needed one more book from a discount place in New York so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. I'm a cheapskate. And, you know, discount books. So one more book and you skip the shipping cost. And there was the report on unidentified flying objects by Air Force Captain Edward Ruppo, who had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. This was 58. And I figured it was marked down $2.95 to a dollar, which is what shipping would have been, so it wasn't going to cost me anything. I didn't have an opinion on flying saucers. I didn't know anything. I'm one of those crazy guys who think if you're going to have an opinion, it should be based on evidence, data, information, you know. That's not a popular viewpoint, but it's mine. Anyway, and I figured, look, the Air Force was co-sponsoring our program. Pretty sharp guys. If these things were using nuclear power plants for flying around, that would certainly help our program. And what the heck? It wasn't costing me anything. It'd be worth a laugh at worst. So I read the book. I shared it with a neighbor who was 10 years older than I was, and he was an engineer, and he was more impressed than I was. Moved off to California after the program got canceled. Well, I moved just before the program got canceled, fortunately. And read 15 more books. Had a good library, and I was intrigued. And then I found my big surprise, Project Blue Book Special Report number 14. Biggest study ever done on flying saucers for the United States, at least unclassified. And what was crazy was it hadn't been mentioned in any of these 15 or so books that I had read, which seemed a little strange. And it was a privately published version at the University of California, Berkeley Library. So I read it, and the guy, Dr. Leon Davidson, had included the press release that went out when the study was completed. They didn't distribute the report, and the report didn't have the title or say who did the work, but widespread publicity. Quoting from the press release, the Secretary of the Air Force, mind you, who ought to know what he's talking about, one would think. Donald Quarles was his name. He said, quote, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available, unquote. That seems pretty straightforward, and, you know, it solves the problem. There's nothing to flying saucers. The only trouble is, being a data hound as I am, and looking through the 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps, the unknowns weren't 3% or 6 or 12. They were 21.5%.
I was just going to ask if they weren't closer to 20%.
21.5% of 3,201 sightings. And in addition, there was a separate category called insufficient information. That was 9.3%. So it was a double-barreled lie, flat-out lie.
Wow.
You know, it wasn't a question of it was 3.5% and he said 3. I mean, from 3 to 21.5 is not just a little arithmetic error.
Yeah.
Furthermore, I found, to my shock, they did a quality evaluation of all the sightings. The better the quality of the sighting, the more likely to be an unknown. They asked the obvious question, is there really, I mean, they had 3,201 cases to work with. Is there really any difference between the unknowns, the only ones we care about, and the knowns? Well, they did a chi-square statistical analysis looking at 6 different observables, you know, apparent size, color, shape, speed, that sort of thing. The probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%.
Oh, my gosh.
So you look at all this data, and you say, hey, this is a flat-out lie. Now, I was working under security, and get accustomed to sort of sometimes tiptoeing around the truth, but you try to avoid outright lying. Well, he didn't avoid it.
No.
He stuck his foot in the lie bucket. I mean, and I've seen a number of newspaper articles. This was October 25th, I think, 1955 was the press release. And I've included it in the copy of Blue Book Special Report 14. It's available from me. You can see it on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. You got to spell Friedman right, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N.com. And so anybody can look at this and see flat-out lie. Well, that finding that inspired me. I joined APRO and NICAP, the two old UFO groups, got their newsletters, didn't do anything publicly until another one of those crazy coincidences. I lived in Indianapolis and was active with a Hemophilia Foundation group, and we had Frank Edwards as a speaker at one of our fundraising meetings. And Frank was a newsman who'd written a book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business. So I got to know Frank. I mean, I got to know him before he wrote the book, but he became famous for the book. And he sent me a copy when I moved on to Pittsburgh to work for Westinghouse. And I called him and I said, Frank, I want to do something. You know everybody. He was a newsman who knew everybody. And give me some names and see what I can do here in Pittsburgh. He gave me some names. One of them was a radio talk show host, producer, at KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the big early radio stations, clear channel, 50,000 watts, all that sort of thing. And I called, and they said, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. Well, as it happens, less than a month later, they called me because somebody had canceled out. They called me at 6:30. Could I be on your 7 o'clock program, please?
Oh, my gosh.
I lived near the station. And, I would love to know how many people that they called first that couldn't make it, you know. So I did my first show, and somebody at work, a woman who was a technology assistant, engineering assistant at Westinghouse, Astro Nuclear Lab, heard me on the radio, asked me to speak to her book review club, which was reading Frank Edwards' book. So my first lecture was in her living room. And I did that program a number of times, and I was learning my trade, you might say. And the breakthrough came when, again, serendipitously, if there is such a word, I'm driving to work from downtown Pittsburgh to Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab, which was out of town, in the small town of Large, PA, with a woman PhD who was a supervisor out there, not my supervisor, but she was. And I'd only ridden with her twice, I think. My car was in the garage. I said, gee, Joanne, I'd really like to speak out at Carnegie Mellon. And she says, well, why don't you talk to the dean? And I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Why don't you give him a call?
Okay.
You know, so I call him, and we set a date. And then it's during the day, a few weeks later, and he asks me, how much do you want? Well, I know I'd have to take most of a day of work off. $100? Figuring he'd cut me down to 50, but, you know, this is way back when, 1967. And so he said, sold. And then, because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in the series, $1,500,
$1,700,
what?
Oh, my gosh.
So I did the talk. Things went very well. He wrote a nice letter to the agency from whom he had booked the other speakers, and they booked me in a really important talk, as it turns out, Engineering Society of Detroit. Now, that's not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes, you understand. That's hard-nosed engineers. And so, and $300 plus expenses. I mean, I'm getting in a big time here.
No kidding.
So I went up there and discovered that they'd been sold out for 3 weeks for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and there wasn't one negative question. And so I did a lot more professional groups, and finding the response was great. And I stress this because I wasn't talking to nutty groups. These are down-to-earth sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, sections of the Institute of Electric and Electronic Engineers and stuff. And they just responded extremely well. And I asked Westinghouse, I said, look, you know, I've got a clearance, I've got a wife, I got a house, I got kids, I got a mortgage, I have a job that I want to keep. I need some rules, folks. So they got back to me, Stan, there are three rules. You can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist, but we would like you to start each lecture with a disclaimer that the views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. I said, fine, that sounds great. What more could you ask for? Well, there was one more thing. I got a call from a colleague working on nuclear rockets at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And Glenn says, Stan, how about giving a talk to our local chapter of the American Nuclear Society? I said, fine, love to. I'm a member. He said, no, I mean on an expense account. He's in Los Alamos, New Mexico. I'm in Pittsburgh. I say, well, I don't make those decisions, so I go up through management. Sure, go ahead. And I did it openly. In other words, with everybody knowing on an expense account that I was going to be there to give a lecture on flying saucers are real. It wasn't, well, don't say anything to anybody, but you can go out on business. You can guys can find something to talk about, which we could have. But we had over 500 people there.
Whoa.
One of their bigger crowds. And again, no nasty, noisy negativists. So I stress all of this so that when I finally made the transition after the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, it was because of the enthusiastic response of my professional colleagues.
Now,
all over the country.
I find
what?
That really interesting because...
Well,
I mean,
go through all that long routine because I don't want people to think that professional people wouldn't listen to a lecture on flying saucers, would they? Yes, they did. And I judge by the question and answer period, see. They've been extremely friendly. I've given over 700 lectures altogether. I've only had 11 hecklers. Two of them were drunk. And you get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics. I mean, I come on strong. I'm not an apologist to ufologists. I start every lecture by saying some UFOs are alien spacecraft. We're dealing with the cosmic Watergate. There are no good arguments against that. And we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. You know, just a shy, retiring kind of guy. And
well,
so,
this is one of the great things about your presentation, that you come right up and you put everything out on the table. So look,
why not? What have I got to lose? I mean, I don't worry about my boss. I'm my boss. You know?
Well, yeah, and you've got all the facts to back up every single thing you say. And
that's the point.
So wonderful to listen to you speak.
Yeah, and I have encouraged other people to speak out. And I said, get your facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. And I learned a lesson way back in fifth grade. Our fourth grade teacher became our fifth grade teacher, and one day in science, in quotes, she's telling us that the sun stands still and the earth and the other planets move around the sun. And I said, no, Miss Gutkin, I just read in my encyclopedia. We bought it for 49 cents a volume at the supermarket, you understand. I said, no, the whole system, the whole solar system, moving around the center of the galaxy, 12 miles a second. The number's going to stick with me forever. And she gave me a hard time. No, that's not the way it was. It wasn't what she was taught and so forth. So I wasn't accustomed to being put down by a teacher because I was an A student. So the next day I brought in the encyclopedia. And she reluctantly conceded that, well, maybe that's the way it was. But I learned a lesson. If you're going to stick your neck out, better make sure you have your facts in hand. Very important lesson, and I learned that it was useful in high school debating, and I've done debates on the UFO scene. And it's one of the remarkable things about the nasty, noisy negativists. They never put facts in their head. They don't do their homework. They do their research by proclamation.
Yeah.
And they're easy targets. I mean, I was on with Michael Shermer, publisher, Dr. Michael Shermer, publisher of Skeptic Magazine. We were on Coast to Coast Radio, and we had both been on the Larry King show almost 3 weeks earlier, where you know, his major contribution was playing with little alien dolls while the rest of us were trying to get some facts on the table. George Norrie was on that show. Fife Symington from Arizona was on the show. Jesse Marcel Jr. was on the show. Anyway, I challenged him to a debate on Coast to Coast, and it was arranged, and I got 80% of the vote after 3 hours. Why? Because he didn't know anything. I had read two of his books. He hadn't done any homework. He started off by saying, and you'll hear this argument often, look, there's really nothing to this. When you deal with strange phenomena, of course you're going to get a residue 5% that can't be identified. That doesn't mean anything. And so I blasted him with Blue Book Special Report 14, with the UFO evidence, you know, 18.9 or so percent couldn't be explained, with the Condon Report, 30% couldn't be explained. It was down here thereafter for him, and he couldn't dodge. And it was a radio program. He couldn't play with dolls, you know. So it's so typical, and it's one of the points I try to make with the SETI cultists, as I call them in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, the cult of SETI, which stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, as everybody knows, you know, not Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. But they'll always tell you there is no evidence, there is no data. And I debated with Seth Shostak on Coast to Coast and won that debate, too, 57-33-10. There was a third category tie or something. But they, if you look at their references, they don't look at the large-scale scientific studies. What they really mean is not that there is no evidence. I'm not going to look for any evidence. If these things are real, who needs SETI?
Right.
You know, learn sign language. Well, the thing that's disturbing is that it's based on bad science. They assume that aliens would want to send us a signal. Why? Did Columbus send a signal to the natives in the New World? I don't think so.
Well, is there any possibility that if there is life elsewhere in the universe, and I certainly believe that there is, but that something that they're doing out there could be giving off radio signals that we could pick up?
Well, there's certainly that publicity. If they're stuck at the level of technology of the listeners. But we've only had radio, really, for a little over 100 years. First transatlantic signal came to Canada, as a matter of fact, from England up to Newfoundland. And so 100 years. Well, Zeta Reticuli, my favorite star system, is a billion years older than the Sun. So to say that nobody is more advanced than we are, stuck with our ancient technology, is silly.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't use a slide rule anymore. I did when I started work in industry, and I got a shock. I told that to, went through, you know, all of the ways that technology has changed in the last 60 years. I said, look, I started work 50 years ago. I was using a slide rule. Looked around the class at the University of Detroit. Any of you know what a slide rule is? Not one student! That was less than 50 years. Boy, you want to seem old, you know. But that's the first thing. Why would anybody try to send a signal to us?
You know, I tell my kids about the days when we didn't have cell phones and not everybody had a computer in their house.
Yeah. Oh, you mean not everybody had a computer? I thought they always did. You know, it's that kind of thing.
How did you live without email and texting? I mean, well, we talk to people, you know.
Yeah, and the phone.
Yeah.
Hey, and you even talked to an operator when I started using the phone.
Yeah. You know what? Rich's grandmother used to be a telephone operator in New York City. She was one of those people, like, to place a call, you have to call the operator and tell them what number you wanted, and
she would
take the little plug and connect it.
Wow. Yeah, or they'd call you back. It was a long-distance call.
Yeah.
So that's the first problem. The second problem is, why limit them to our technology? And we're going to be able to pick up the signal and decode it, if you will. Or maybe they're supposed to be sending us a signal in English. Hello, Earth! How you doing down there? You know.
No, we have trouble enough with languages, current, contemporary languages here on our planet, much less ancient English. I mean, look how much trouble high school kids have reading Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, that's
it could be ancient Hebrew, you understand.
A few hundred years apart. Exactly. You get something like Chinese or Hebrew that's written by totally different rules.
Yeah.
You know, it's written backward or up and down.
These guys think we're the center of the universe, the crown of creation.
Yeah.
And I don't think we know any more about what's going on out there, meaning the local neighborhood, than the gorillas in a nature preserve in Africa. They think their own world is all there is. And I mention that because, you see, my concept of what's going on out there is that within, we know that within 55 light years there's a couple thousand stars, and at least 5% are similar to the sun, and you expect them to have planets, and we've found planets around 300 stars, and not Earth-like planets, because our techniques aren't good enough. They will be in 20 years or so. But the point is that I think there's civilizations all over the place. SETI doesn't allow for colonization and migration, you see. That's very important in how we got here, isn't it, in North America? My ancestors were living in Europe 110 years ago. They migrated. You know, people moved from one place to another to get away from bad things or to look for gold or all kinds of reasons. So they don't allow for that. And the Drake equation, the hallowed symbol of the SETI cult, people forget that we don't have numbers to put in that. What's the average lifespan of a civilization? You got 200-300 billion stars in the galaxy. We know about one civilization on one planet, and you're going to put a number in that's the average lifespan of a civilization? Is it 500 years or 5,000 or 5 million? And what if they...
Like in the study of UFOs and this whole all the related fields, it's as if all the rules that apply to any other branch of science just don't. And I think you mentioned that in your book as well. That I mean, you were talking about the legal aspect of testimony and how highly regarded eyewitness testimony is in a court of law.
Yeah.
But in UFO research, if you get someone who comes and says, "I was out at such and such a time at this place, and here's what I saw, and it had these colors on it," people are going to say, well, you know, it's just some guy who saw it.
Well, yeah, I talked to a judge.
I saw this man commit this robbery, they'll say, well, that's it, he saw you, you're guilty.
Yeah, and you realize how much more accurate you have to be when describing a robber. I mean, if you say, 6 feet plus or minus 20%, that's not good enough, because that includes most of the people, you know. But if you say it was going 1,000 miles an hour, so what if it was 800 or 1,200 and it stopped dead? Well, maybe it was still moving 10, 20, 30 miles an hour. What difference does it make? You've just excluded standard flying things. And if you say it went straight up and made no noise, you've certainly excluded all of them. How accurate do you have to be? But remember, we have physical trace cases. We have radar visual cases. We have loads of pilot sightings, often backed up with radar. I mean... I get so upset when people say there is no evidence.
Yeah.
That's nonsense. That's laziness.
People say, oh, you believe in UFOs? Yeah.
No, I don't believe in UFOs. I know that the evidence is overwhelming that our planet is being visited, that some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Most are not. Hey, most isotopes aren't fissionable. So what? You want to build a nuclear bomb or a nuclear reactor? Get the one that is. Who cares about
exactly.
The one that isn't? You know, it's the basketball coach approach. In other words, fewer than 1% of the people are 7 feet tall. And the basketball coach says, I don't care. And don't tell me about midgets. Give me 1 7-footer. You keep the rest.
Yeah.
And, you know, how to misuse statistics. Let's say 1%, will be generous, of the people are 7 feet tall. So 1 out of 100. So what are the chances of finding 2 7-footers at the same time in the same place? Well, if you're watching an NBA game, it's probably very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not random distribution of
workers. Right.
Now, and another one of the favorite objections of the nasty, noisy negativist is that governments can't keep secrets. Washington leaks like a sieve. Really? Well, in the book, there's a chapter on the Cosmic Watergate, and I give several programs, multi-billion-dollar programs that were kept secret for decades. You need not only a security clearance, but a need to know. And the ancient academics who get so upset about who can't keep secrets aren't people who've had clearances. They're accustomed to, you know, a large project is 6 professors and 24 grad students. I mentioned working on nuclear airplanes, and that wasn't a black program. I mean, title on the door was there, General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. 3,500 people, $100 million in a year in 1958. Oof. That's a lot of activity. It was a joy. I had somebody once say to me, must be awful tough to work on a classified program. And I said, why? You get to spend money like crazy on good equipment, on expensive materials, work with outstanding colleagues. You get to present papers at classified meetings. It's not publish or perish, though. You got to contribute something. You got to produce data, facts, evidence. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of misconceptions out there about the world of UFOs, the data available. I mean, I hear people saying, no physical evidence. If Michael Shermer wants an alien body, then he'll believe. So where's a piece of a black hole? Or a piece of a neutron star?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've never seen Tokyo. I have to take somebody's word that it's there, you know. So it's a crazy world we live in, and flying saucers seem to bring out the worst in the noisy negativists, but I should stress, as I point out in the chapter on public opinion polls in the book Flying Saucers and Science, there are more believers than non-believers, and the greater the education, the more likely to believe, which comes as a shock to people.
That's very telling.
Yeah, and, well, you know, Carl Sagan and I said we were classmates. I was at his home in New York State not too many years before he died. He twice publicly and in a book said there are interesting UFO sightings that are not reliable. There are reliable sightings that are not interesting, but there are no interesting and reliable sightings. He doesn't cite any evidence, and, of course, as I indicated earlier, that's totally false. The more reliable, the more likely to be unexplainable, and they're the interesting ones. So people get away with this kind of nonsense. It's truly incredible. It's funny how they never refer to the PhD theses that have been done. There have been about 24 of them. There have been universities where courses have been taught on flying, about flying saucers, sometimes by the physics department. Had fun visiting East Texas State University. The physics department had a course, and people were opposed to it, and then when they saw how many people signed up, the English department wanted it. Well, it should be on the literature of flying saucers, because the income to the department was related to how many people would take the course. They sponsored me for a campus-wide lecture. We had 1,350 people. But nobody's interested in flying saucers, you know.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. It's so frustrating to hear people talk about it, like, oh, you really believe in that?
Well,
gosh,
if they're
it's
quietly...
It's not a question of belief, as you mentioned.
You know, yeah. I spoke at RIT there almost years ago now, Rochester Institute of Technology, and there's talk about maybe somebody bringing me back to do that again with the Barnes & Noble bookstore down there, and I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll come through, but...
Well, you could come and see our UFO meetup group in person this time.
That's right. Doing it by phone is not exactly the closest way to see people, but
our meetup group really enjoyed that.
It was a pleasant experience for me, and I was glad I saw how many people wanted books. My goodness. It was nice, and people got a chance to ask questions, and you know, interesting experience that I've had over the years is that people have no trouble with the data I present, these large-scale scientific studies, the quality evaluations, all that sort of thing, because, A, they didn't know anything about them beforehand. But what they really want to know are the answers to the why questions. And there's a whole piece on my website, www.stanfriedman.com, on the UFO why questions. You know, why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't the aliens land on the White House lawn? We're nice, friendly types, aren't we?
Yeah.
It's a no-fly zone, of course. Shoot first, ask questions. That's the American way, you know.
They don't show up over the White House, but, you know, we generally send jets after them.
Yeah, we did in 1952, and there were orders given to shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so.
In 2002, didn't it happen again? I know it did happen again.
Well, the same, a similar experience happened, yeah, and we went after them. I don't know whether that rule is still in place, but in 52, a general, Air Force general, admitted we'd scrambled jets 300 times. Mm. And, you know, the funny thing is, the shoot them down story wasn't in the Washington Post or the New York Times. It was in the Louisville Courier Journal and a whole bunch of other papers, and we know it's real because the head of the American Rocket Society, a guy named Farnsworth, wrote a letter to President Truman saying he didn't think that was a good idea to have that rule in place. Not very friendly approach, you know. But,
well, I remember hearing about one case in South America, I think it was, where UFOs appeared 2 days in a row, and the first day the military sent out a plane after them and had no effect. I mean, they were shooting at it and had absolutely no effect. The second day, the UFO came back, and somebody asked the general, well, why didn't you order them to shoot again? And he said, because I spent so much money yesterday, and it didn't do anything. I don't have the money.
Story.
I can't keep doing this.
Well, look, you know, you don't use slingshots against machine guns.
Well, right. And if slingshots are all you have, you don't waste all your ammunition on something that's not going to affect.
That's right. And look, I have heard 7 stories over the years of more planes going up that came back down. And if I've heard 7 stories, then there's got to be a lot more out there. And I'd love to hear from anybody who's listening who was on the ground when the plane went up to chase a UFO and didn't come back. My website has my phone number. It has my email addresses. You'll like it. FS for flying saucer, PHYS for physicist, at rogers.com. So anybody can reach me. I don't hide. Now, I live in Fredericton, New Brunswick. My post office box is in Maine, but if you ask the operator in Maine, she won't know my phone number because I live in Fredericton, New Brunswick. Area code 506. I won't give out the number now because the last time I tried that on the radio program, then the phone started ringing.
Yeah,
not a good idea to try to listen when the call waiting is ringing in the background.
Yeah, people don't always realize that we're broadcasting live. And a lot of people listen on the archives, so they don't know exactly when we broadcast live.
Yeah, good point. Good point. But you've got a group there that's interested in UFOs.
Very much so, yeah.
And there are groups like that all over the country, and MUFON has, what, over 3,000 members now.
Yeah.
And the kicker here is if we could get the media to do its job. One of those PhD theses was on how bad the press coverage was over a 30-year period from Northwestern University, Professor Herb Strentz. And he had some scathing remarks about the failure of the media to do its job. And I'm not resentful because I've had bad coverage, generally speaking. I've had very good coverage. But it's just that the subject isn't well covered by the New York Times or the Washington Post. They're suffering from what I call the David Susskind syndrome. He used to have a radio, television talk show out of New York. Way back in the 70s, they brought me in. They wanted me to find him a good skeptic. I said, there aren't any, but here's how to reach Phil Klass. They wanted a good abductee. I got them Betty Hill and John Fuller, the author of Interrupted Journey. Incidentally, they can read the update on that story by, 50 years, I guess 40 years anyway, captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience by myself and Kathleen Marden, who did most of the work. She's Betty's niece. She had access to all the tapes and so forth and did a comparative analysis. Did really good job on that. And that's listed on my website and stuff, but there's an awful lot of information out there. And, you know, I don't pretend to speak for aliens when I get asked the why questions. You know, I have never met with an alien. Some people are surprised. You mean you've never even had a good sighting? I said, no. So how can you be interested? I said, look, I never saw a neutron or a gamma ray, and I chased them for 14 years. that was interesting, too. So there's lots of data out there. And
it's true. A lot of UFO researchers have not had sightings. I mean, I've spoken
right.
to many who have, but it's interesting that a lot of people who are involved in the research have not actually seen one themselves.
Well, that holds of so many things. I said I've never seen Tokyo. It's there. And, you know, I'm working on a new book, and this is different, but it will have a chapter on UFOs, but you'll love the title. It's Impossible, Isn't It? About all the stupid things said by smart people that have stood in the way of progress. You know, the British Astronomer Royal who said space travel is utter bilge a year before Sputnik went up. Nobody would ever spend the money to get into space. And, you know, where's the good astronomy coming? A lot of it coming from space, isn't it? You know, the Hubble and a whole bunch of other great observatories up there. But there are medical situations. Kathleen Martin is working on this one, too. She's got strong medical interests. And it's a really sad story about how many people's lives have been lost because the people at the top of a hospital or doing research or something were so dead set against changing how they were doing things. And people died because of it. And so, you know, you have to look around today. Science seems to be operating for the benefit of scientists at universities, not for the benefit of society. Now, somebody will send me a nasty letter about that, but there are plenty of examples of that.
Yeah. Dan, there are two things. There's first of all, there's a question on the message board that I wanted to bring up.
Sure.
And, concerning the Cash Landrum UFO incident on
yes.
December 29th of 1980, and this person wrote in and was wondering whether, in your opinion, the object they saw could have been a nuclear-powered spacecraft possibly created by the U.S. military.
Well, I've talked to the primary investigator on that, of course, was John Schussler, an aerospace engineer who worked on NASA programs for 30-some years, and he wrote the book on that case, literally. And we talked about that, and because of my work on nuclear airplanes and stuff, and certainly the effects on the people were consistent with radiation. And it was obvious that the craft was having some problems. But it went away, and you'd say there were a whole bunch of helicopters that showed up, which was denied for quite some time. And the kicker is that it finally went off and went out of sight way away. If it was one of ours, you'd think they'd have escorted it to some place, and it would have come down, you know, to protect it. So possibly, but not likely, is I guess what I would say. It's a darn good case, though. John Schussler is the expert.
That is a really compelling case, I think. I don't recall all
yeah.
the details, but I know I've read a couple of books about it.
Well, a woman and her friend and the grandson of one of them. And there were radiation burns, or what I would call burns, that people got sick in the way you get sick when you've been exposed to too much radiation. The car got hot, had trouble touching the door handles. The one who died earliest was the one who got out of the car, was closest to the object. So it's a darn good case. I just saw something somewhere where people were, on one of the websites, one of the blogs, people were saying stupid things about it. And there's a warning to everybody. Don't believe everything you read on the Internet.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly like, you know, people try to go to the source and get good information. They might go and read the Blue Book report, and you can't believe everything you see there either.
Well, no, look at the people who've been going through the Blue Book files and found a whole bunch of cases that were explained, in quotes. When you look more carefully, that case wasn't explained.
Yeah.
They put a label on it, not the same thing.
Right.
You had another question, I think.
Sort of a lead-in from the comment about the Cash Landrum case and about people being affected by the radiation. It just struck me that that's another thing that turns up in more than one UFO case.
Oh, Rendlesham Forest, there were some hot spots on the ground, sure.
Yeah, and we were talking about how science seems to be for the sake of science these days, and that people aren't really looking at the effects of these UFO sightings on the people who are seeing them.
That's right.
And, you know, and that just, it reminded me of something that I saw in your book when I was reading Flying Saucers and Science toward the end, when you said what you were really hoping for is that we will recognize that we're all in this together. We're all Earthlings.
Yeah.
And that people will begin to look at facts and not be afraid to face the truth.
Well, you know, one thing I found is that people haven't learned a lot from history. I know a lot of the younger generation isn't aware that in World War II, 50 million Earthlings were killed by other Earthlings. 50 million! 1,700 cities were destroyed. This year, we Earthlings collectively will spend a little over $1 trillion on things military. And 30,000 children will die needlessly of preventable disease and starvation every single day. Now, something's wrong with that picture. From my viewpoint, I think aliens must look upon us as a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. I mean, look what's happening in Gaza as we speak, and in a whole bunch of other, in Afghanistan, and in other places. Look at those massacres in Africa. It's like we think so much of ourselves, but it's okay to kill a lot of other people. And
yeah.
I find that incredible, and I wonder, and people would say, well, how do you know aliens are any better? Either you learn to live at peace with your neighbors, or you get destroyed by the technology that characterizes advancement. And so, by neighbor, I mean anybody you can reach. That could be across your solar system, across your local neighborhood, or whatever.
Right. And if they've been able to get over that hurdle that's been stopping us, where people say, well, you just can't get there from here, you can't cross those distances. Okay, if somebody was able to come from someplace as far away as the nearest planet, the nearest star system, the nearest whatever, then clearly they've been able to put aside some of their differences and focus on the task at hand a lot better than we've been able to.
Incidentally, you get people saying, well, look how much energy it would take to get to another galaxy. Yeah, Andromeda's 2 million light years away. Why should I care? Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2 are 39 light years away. Not 39 million or 39,000, but 39. And they're only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. That means they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So we're out in the boonies. These guys got next door neighbors. And, oh, by the way, the two stars are a billion years older than the sun. One would expect that they would know some things we don't know. So why worry about across the galaxy? The galaxy is maybe 100,000 light years across. Who cares? I mean,
we couldn't consider crossing the Atlantic Ocean at one point because we didn't have the technology.
That's right.
I mean, yeah, if your technology is equivalent to riding a bicycle, then yeah, there are places you can't get to.
Not in a reasonable time.
We figured out how to do that.
That's for sure. And they got a kick out of the head of the Hayden Planetarium saying, oh, the Voyager spacecraft, our fastest craft, would take 70,000 years to get to the nearest star. And experimenters like to be around when their experiment's finished. It doesn't have a propulsion system on it. It's coasting. It's like dumping a bottle in the ocean and saying, well, I'll just see how long it takes to get across the ocean, and that'll...
And then complaining because it's not getting there.
That's
the best part.
Impossible. No, you're right. And there's a lot of these silly things. You'd think astronomers would know better, but part of the problem is us physicists. We use units that don't mean anything to somebody. I ask classes, what's 1G acceleration? 32.2 feet per second squared. I said, okay, that's true, but how do you relate that to a Corvette? And they look at me like I'm speaking Swahili. It's 21 miles per hour per second is what it boils down to. The speed of light, 186,000 miles a second. Well, how do you relate that to anything meaningful? 670 million miles an hour. And the real question is, how long does it take at 1G to get to the speed of light? It's a multiple-choice question, 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, 1. And you'd be surprised how many well-educated people guess 1,000 or 100 or 10. It's only 1. And people want half an Einstein. I mean, yeah, the speed of light's the limit, but let's forget about the fact that as you get closer to the speed of light, time slows down for the things moving that fast. And at a mere 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months, pilot time. Pilot time, not the time of the twin brother left behind, you know.
Well, Sam, it's appropriate that we're talking about the speed of time because it flew by. It's actually 8 o'clock.
Oh, yes.
And Unfortunately, we have to go to break, and then I have Marissa Ryan coming on for the second hour.
Good. Enjoy.
I can't tell you how happy I am that you're going to be speaking in Laughlin next month. I am so excited about seeing you there. That's going to be terrific.
Well, I'm sort of looking forward to it. I haven't been there since the first conference was held in Vegas 20-some years ago. They asked me back because I was the highest on the list of people you want to hear talk.
Well,
so I'm going to be out there, and it'll be warm instead of this 30 below zero stuff.
Won't that be wonderful? I wake up every day and say, oh, thank goodness I'm going to Laughlin.
Yeah, me too.
So
well,
you'll be
again,
on the Wednesday.
The website is www.stantonfriedman.com, and I can get all my books. Everything I send out, I autograph all the books, papers, and stuff like that. So I had somebody say, well, I'll see you in Laughlin because I want to get an autograph copy. Everything I send out is autographed.
It's fun to get to talk to you in person, too. I mean, yeah.
We've got to see each other more often.
Books, but it's so much fun to get to meet you and speak with you. That's just a blast.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Since you'll be there on Wednesday, you'll be at the Meet the Speaker party Wednesday evening.
Yes.
I assume. Wonderful.
Yes. Yes, I will.
Great.
Hey, whoever turned away a party.
Absolutely. Stan, thank you so much for being on
My
Through
pleasure.
The Keyhole. I've really, really enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. And don't go away, everyone. We're going to take a bit of a break, and when we come back,
I'll call, press 1.
Ryan.
To purchase additional minutes, press 2. For direct...
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'm host Karen Dolan, and my guest this hour is Marissa Ryan. Marissa is a psychic who has been invited to come and speak at the International UFO Congress this year. She's the first psychic ever to be invited to the UFO Congress. And I am so excited. I can't wait to hear your presentation there, Marissa. Welcome to Through the Keyhole.
Oh, thank you, Karen. I'm excited to be on.
There are so many things I want to ask you. I was reading in your bio, you talked about having helped to solve a murder. And it seems like it was not that long ago. It was just in 2002?
Well, yes. I have not been doing this my entire life, ever. I mean, I don't feel like I was born psychic or at least even had acknowledge of the abilities. It just kind of happened overnight for me, which is kind of different than some others. But what happened was, my mother and my niece passed away. It was pretty traumatic 2 days apart for me, and it just kind of got me to searching about life and death and if there's life after death, and started doing a little bit of research and kind of started, you know, thinking I really wanted to talk to my niece and really wanted to find out how she died. And then it was all of a sudden, about 2 years after their death, one night, I had this murdered girl show up in my office in my home.
Oh, my gosh.
And she was just standing there calling my name. When I turned around, I saw her, and she showed me her entire murder. And then she kept urging me to call the detectives and the police about she had information, and she wanted to share specific information with them, and at first I thought I was making it up, and I had no clue if it was real or not, but I kind of went along with it, and I called them and said some things that made them think I was part of the murder.
Well, yeah, I can understand the police seeing it that way. I mean, they must have been thinking, well, how could you have had any information about this at all unless you were in on it?
Right. I did. I knew information that was not disclosed in any articles or anything, and I started working with them on the case once I proved to them that I was not part of the murder. And it was like once this girl and I connected, she told everyone on the other side I could hear her and see her and talk to her. And that next thing I know, they were in my car and following me around the mall and at my work.
Oh, wow.
And it just opened. I mean, it was just like instant boom overnight. And, I mean, there were some things I had to learn how to control it, learn how to control them from, you know, driving me crazy. But it very much was kind of like the movie Ghost, you know, where they're just like singing 99 bottles of beer on the wall until I cooperate.
Yeah. Well, how do you learn something like that? I mean, how do you learn to control this ability that just turned up out of nowhere?
Well, I kind of had to teach myself a system of communication with them. And it was kind of like it was like hit or miss experimental for both them and me, and we just kind of worked together. But as far as I was trying to find a psychic to help me, and I had found this one lady, and she said, you know, you need to set time and hours. You need to have a schedule and be firm. And it was like, wow, you know, I had something to offer them, and they needed my help. So I just said, you know, you've got to do it on my terms, and I was very specific. And I kind of have a tough attitude sometimes, so I was like, you know, this is the way it's going to be, or I'm not helping you. And they obliged. I mean, they were great.
Wow.
And that's how it worked. We just started working together, and different spirits would come in, and I learned what I could say and what I couldn't say to people, because I wasn't going to blurt out. At first, you're excited. At first, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, my gosh, this is so exciting. And at the same time, you're saying, is this really happening, and why me? And you're kind of in disbelief, and then the more validation you get, even first 6 months I worked on the murder, I didn't know if I was blowing smoke. I had no idea, because they wouldn't tell me anything. The police wouldn't validate for me. They wouldn't say anything to me. They were always suspicious of everything I said, and I was doing automatic writing with her, and I was sketching photos, pictures that she would tell me, and just giving them information, and then boom, one day they just finally came with the case file and sat down, and it all matched. And that that was the first confirmation that really went, okay, wow, I'm like really doing this. It's amazing. So
and that is amazing.
It's been really fun ever since.
So, wow, really fun. I'm just blown away that you would describe it that way. I've never had this kind of experience, and that's not how I would have thought that you would see it.
It's really fun. It is.
Wow.
It is such an amazing opportunity to be able to help people, to bring closure, to connect. And all I can say is that the work that I do is it's completely centered and focused around love. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it's amazing what can happen, and I've just seen amazing things happen. My life has changed to some degree. All I could say is it's gotten nothing but better. I've seen things unfold that were so amazingly coincidental that are just like, wow, you know, the aha moments every day. And then to be able to connect, it's the most fulfilling thing I've probably ever done in my entire life.
Now, I've heard that this kind of experience, like when you talked about the aha moments and coincidences and things just, you know, falling together in a certain way, I've heard that this happens more frequently once people start paying attention to it. And, you know, there's some question as to whether it actually happens more often or whether you're just noticing. But, we're having a couple of technical little things going on this evening.
That wouldn't surprise me in my world.
Does this happen to you a lot?
A lot. Yes, a lot.
Okay, that's what's going on. You know, one other night we had severe phone problems, and it's when I was trying to interview someone who was investigating the Shanley Hotel in Colorado.
There you go.
And we had the worst time of the phones, and I think we ended up only doing like a 20-minute interview because we just couldn't make it happen.
Well, the energy, when spirit, I tend to get a lot of spirits around me, and they're excited about the work, and they're excited about your show, and so the energy gets really high, and it can cause all kinds of electrical disturbances.
Oh, my gosh. Now, when you see the spirits, do they appear to you the same as a living person, flesh and blood, or do they look different?
Oh, well, thank goodness they do not appear to me as a regular living person, because I'd probably lose my mind. It is very difficult for spirits to, and this is from, I speak from my experience and from my knowledge of interviewing them and working with spirits, it's difficult for them to actually form into a solid form because it takes so much energy, but also it's really not safe for us. when they do that. Because, I mean, if we were going around seeing spirits and hearing them like we would every, you know, normal people, then it would be very hard to differentiate if we were losing our mind or not. So I see them, a lot of it is third eye intuition in my mind. I have a little screen there and they will appear. But many times I see them where it's, I see a complete outline of them. I can see color. Usually, for some reason, I've noticed like their hair and head seems to be more solid form. Their body is more transparent. And they're usually kind of floating. I rarely see them touching the ground. I don't know why, but that's usually how I see them. And they do, so they do appear where I can tell the difference because I can see through them. So I definitely know they're not alive.
Okay. Well, I've read some accounts of people seeing ghosts that they didn't realize at the time were ghosts. I mean, I think everyone's heard the stories of someone who, you know, maybe saw an old friend one day and then later found out that the person had actually died the day before.
That is possible. I have seen some in solid form. One of the very fun ways that they try and get in touch with us so that we know we're around is they can project their facial image on another human being.
Oh.
And when they do that, it's at a flash of a moment, and a lot of people have experienced it, and that will sometimes make people think, wow, I actually saw them in human form. And it's just their reflection, their face. I mean, if you see someone, you go, oh my gosh, looks just like my Aunt Mary. Mm-hmm. It's her actually flashing her face onto another human to let you know she's there, to give you that validation. So there are some rules. I mean, from what I've been told by spirits, they do have some rules. There are certain things that they can't go too far with. You know what I mean? It's almost as if they have their own set of rules for our own safety.
Really? Can you tell us about some of the rules? I've never heard anything like that before.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to simplify it by saying rules. I mean, they're very, most of them that I talk to seem to be pretty courteous. Some of the rules are they're not going to come in, and from what they tell me in the sessions that I do with my clients, they cannot alter our lives. They cannot come in and change our free will or outcomes. They do not have that ability.
But do they try to contact people sometimes to get them to change things?
They, well, through psychics and mediums, they can give warnings. They'll sometimes give signs. I mean, I had a client whose dead mother left a 15-minute message on her answering machine.
Oh, wow.
And it was to warn them that the brother was going in for surgery, and the tumor was gone, and they didn't need to do the surgery. And it all ended up playing out exactly like she said.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I had another lady who brought me her cell phone, and her son who passed left a message, and it was kind of like an EVP where it was a lot of static, and all of a sudden he said, I love you, Mom. And it was clear as day, his voice.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So, I mean, it's just amazing what they can try and do to contact us. And you know, some of them have to learn how to communicate, you know, some... I've had spirits say, I don't like to travel in people's dreams. I don't like it. It feels icky. You know?
To travel in people's dreams.
Yeah, to come. People, all, you know, a lot of times when people lose a loved one, they'll say, I just want them to come in my dreams. That's all. I just want to be able to touch them and see them again. And mm-hmm. a lot of times the spirits will say, I don't like to go in their dreams, or I haven't learned how yet.
Oh, that's interesting.
They have to learn things. When you go back on the other side, you have to remember your abilities and learn some things that you can do, and you know, that it's an education for both, all of us.
Wow, that's really something, because you would think when someone dies, the people who are still alive would be thinking that the more time passes, the less likely it is that they'd be able to contact that person.
Actually, I have some people that can pass on a Saturday and the spirit will be in my office on Monday to communicate with their family. I have others that it could be 2 months in our time and they're still not ready to communicate. It just depends on the level of the soul that has passed. But what I tell people is, in the beginning, depending on your level of grief, if your grief is really, really heavy, it's thick like a wall and they cannot penetrate it. And as time goes by, that wall gets thinner and thinner and thinner, and then you will start to notice them. There are, I've seen amazing people who have lost a child and within a week have this just amazing peace about them and say, I feel him around me all the time. I know he's here. And then my own sister, it took her probably 5 years before she ever even started noticing anything from her daughter.
And this is the niece that you were talking about.
Yes. Yep, she died.
So, now, you described that it was the death of your mother and your niece that got you sort of thinking about this and becoming aware of this sort of thing happening in your life. Did you ever make contact with either of them, with your mother or your niece?
Well, I did. Actually, my mother died 10 minutes after Thanksgiving dinner. It was her and my father's 50th anniversary. They had exchanged rings at the table. She had a massive heart attack, and I did CPR on her, and she passed instantly. And 2 days later, in the same house, my 21-year-old niece died in her sleep of unknown causes.
Oh, my gosh. 21.
And 21. And unknown. The death certificate says unknown. They have no idea. And, I mean, this is what got me going. I was like, okay, I need answers. I'm a Virgo, you know. I need answers. I need to know.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, I need to know what's going on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started researching, and my mother came to me in a dream right away. I was a sales rep. I used to drive, you know, hundreds of miles a week, and all of a sudden I felt like my mother was sitting in the passenger seat, and I would start talking to her, and I would start getting answers back. She would answer me back, but I literally will be honest, I thought I was making it up.
So the answers are sort of coming into your mind?
They communicate through your thoughts. So it's almost as if you're having a two-way conversation with yourself.
Mm.
But they're answering, and you have to be able to differentiate the difference through the language and the words that they use, and you also have to have trust.
And I imagine it's also the case that you don't always agree with what the other person is saying.
Well,
it's,
for example, if I say,
if
Mom,
it were just you.
If I say, Mom, are you here with me?
Mm-hmm.
She'll say, yeah, I'm sitting right next to you. Instead of saying, you know, oh, yeah, she's in the seat next to me. That would be me making it up. She'll communicate to me as if we're back and forth one-on-one.
Right, good point.
And that's exactly how it works.
So when you started then doing your research, what did you do? I mean, were you looking for books? Did you talk to people?
I started reading books. I was reading a lot of books that I could get my hands on, and different books. And then it was kind of like, you know, I had an understanding and I started having a faith. I learned that one of the first things I learned to do was astral travel. And I wanted to astral travel to the other side, and I wanted to get information, and that was a whole interesting thing right there. And then I ended up having a baby, which was a complete shock, and, you know, got really busy for a year and a half, not really thinking about it.
Now, I remember reading a book on astral travel years ago, and the author said that he discovered that pregnant women are not able to project, that it's like a natural safety thing. It's just not a smart idea for a woman who's pregnant to be projecting,
you know, that's
out of the body. Did you find that was true?
It was, and I got to tell you, I've never even heard of that before until you've just said it, but I didn't. I couldn't do it the whole time I was pregnant.
Wow.
That makes a lot of sense, and that's why I kind of like put everything on the side for about year and a half, and then I kind of got back into it and I sent my sister to a couple mediums to get information, and then all this other stuff started happening. And I was very much into prayer. I was praying all the time. You know, I want the gift to be able to talk to my niece. I want this gift. I want, and I just kept saying it over and over. And then, wow, be careful what you pray for, because I got it. And so I ended up finding out she, you know, can't give me the answer of what she passed from, but she says that she felt very hot and her head hurt. And all of a sudden, she couldn't breathe. It was almost like choking, and then she just lights out. It went dark, and that was all she remembered.
Oh, wow. Was it after that, then, that the murder victim, the young girl, came to you?
It was after that that she came to me, and that was kind of a... It was a really interesting story because a friend of mine who lived 30 miles from me in a place that I grew up in, she had called me, and, you know, she was having some issues, and I said, go see the psychic. She lives by you, and I heard she's really good, and she went to her, and she called me up, and she said, you know, some murdered girl came into my reading, and I don't know anyone who was murdered. And she started researching unsolved murders and found this one, and the girl was from the neighborhood that I grew up in and that she lived in, but her body was found 30 miles out by my house.
Oh, wow.
And she goes, wow, this is a weird connection. So she sent me the email, and it's when I opened up the email and this girl's picture was there, was when I turned around and heard my voice being called. And that's what started the whole thing. That's when I saw this girl.
Wow.
And it was, and then, you know, working on the murder, there was a lot of issues. There was a lot of unsolved. They knew who did it. They couldn't prove it. They didn't have murder weapon. I mean, her head was missing. There was a lot of issues. I mean, I spent days and days searching for her head myself. Trying to find evidence. And finally, one day, she came to me and she says, it's not your job to solve this crime. She said, it was my job to show you something so horrific and amazing that it would get your attention enough so that you would do this work.
So she essentially said, you don't have to do this case, but I want you to take others.
No, she just, it was her case. It was about her case. She didn't, I was trying so hard to solve it, and I wanted closure, and she finally just said, it was not the reason that she came to me to solve her crime. That was not the reason. It was for her to show me something that was gruesome and crazy enough to get my attention so that I could see that I could do it. I've worked on many other cases before, but it's usually clients
that
bring them to me.
That's what I meant. It sounded like she was encouraging you to do this sort of work and to take on other cases, even though she was saying at the same time, you don't have to solve this one.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And so have you worked on many other cases since then?
I've worked on about five others, and it's kind of interesting how it falls into place because 23 years ago I went to the police academy because I wanted to be a homicide investigator.
Oh,
so,
and now you are.
Yeah, so it kind of was very interesting, but I've worked on some missing persons cases and just different some robbery and theft cases, and it's very difficult to work with law enforcement. It's very difficult.
In what way? Because of the bureaucratic red tape or
yes.
Because of a skeptical attitude? Or
both. One thing I've noticed is law enforcement officers are some of the most psychic people there are, and I've had many of them take my classes, and I work with them to teach them to open up their abilities. But at the same time, their livelihood depends on evidence and proof.
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much that's not admissible in court, so it makes it very difficult. They won't go out and search for you to come help them on the case, but if you have something to offer them, they'll usually accept it. But a lot of them still, I mean, I helped one department solve a missing persons, which ended up being a death that I believe was a murder, and, I proved every single thing I said was absolutely correct, but in the report, they only acknowledged that I had information, but they said it wasn't helpful. After I literally told them, you know, where this man was in the ocean, and he was floating face down, and he was in a certain area, and I drew it on a map, and it was identical. But it's bureaucracy. You've got that right.
Wow.
So it
That's
can
really
be frustrating.
Something. I can imagine. So how did you go from this point to working with the Awareness Institute? Did you start the Awareness Institute?
I own the Awareness Institute.
So this is your baby.
This is my baby.
Wow. Tell me about it.
Well, I when this happened to me, I was so frustrated at first because I didn't know what to do or who to talk to or where to go, and I knew there were other people like me. So I wanted to open up an institute that people could come and explore and question everything in the universe, and I would help them find the answers. If I didn't have them, I'd find somebody who did, or I'd help them find the answers within themselves and offer a safe place for them to study and just work where they didn't feel judged and they could feel safe, and that's what I created. And we have all kinds of classes there. It's a lot of fun, and it's just it's a very needed thing, and I have so many people I know that want to open similar facilities, but it's just, you know, finding the right place and the right match. But it's amazing. I thought I'd get flack for doing what I do, and I have been extremely well received, and it's just been so refreshing.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
It's been wonderful.
I just would think that there's a huge amount of interest in this. It just seems, if you walk into any bookstore and, you know, look at this, at books about this topic, and just that is difficult to say because bookstores don't quite know what to do with books about this topic. They kind of lump a lot of odd things together. But anything that has to do with psychic development, psychic ability, any kind of, you call it divination, I mean, I think that's the same sort of thing in a way. A lot of people use tarot cards, and it's not just reading the pictures on the cards. I think they're triggers for our own intuitive abilities.
There are tarot readers, and then there are psychics that use the tarot as a tool to guide them.
Yeah, excellent point.
There's completely two different things. It's like, I love tarot cards. I think they're beautiful, and I own 20 decks, but I do not know how to use them. I don't know how to use them. I don't use any tools. I can't use a pendulum.
I know some people who, you know, assign a specific meaning to each card, and some people who just pull up the cards and get a feel for it. And that always makes me feel like they need a little oomph to access their own intuitive ability.
Absolutely. And tools are great. I mean, tools are great for people need them, and they're great. I just say, when you get the deck, throw away the book and make your own book for what they mean to you. But
well, I did, you know, in that same book where that I was telling you about, the author said that pregnant women can't perform astral projection. He also talked about a teacher that he knew who trained people to read tarot cards in these. And he did that. He would hand somebody a deck of cards and say, just, you know, lay out some cards, pick somebody in the room you think it's for, and tell them a story.
Absolutely.
And he wouldn't let them see a book. He said, just, you don't need a book. Just look at the pictures and say what you think.
That's it. That's how they should be used.
Yeah, and the author of the book said he couldn't believe how often it worked. It was really accurate.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. And it's a great tool. It really is. I love tarot. I think it's beautiful. I took a class once. I couldn't remember anything. I just said, forget it. I'll just rely on spirit. It's so much easier.
Well, right. I mean, that's what we're just saying, is you don't need to remember any of it anyway. You just look at the pictures and say, you know, what kind of impression does this give me?
Yes.
This card came up for a reason. What does it mean?
Yes. It's all a lot of fun. It really is fun.
So, I'm sorry, I interrupted you, though. You were telling us about the Awareness Institute. What is the Awareness Institute? What do you do?
It's a non-denominational educational facility that we basically we teach many different things. We teach past life regression, and we teach astrology and numerology and meditation and psychic development and mediumship development, and we have all kinds of different. I do two retreats a year. I have a beautiful retreat coming up in May, and this is our sixth year of doing two a year, and we usually have about 30 people that get together, and we do all different kinds of projects and classes throughout the weekend, and it's just really great. And it's just great to be where you have like minds. You know, like-minded people, they come together and they go, you know what, I've always felt a little odd, and I feel like I fit in here. You know, people always say to me, I've always felt really strange and like I didn't fit in. And I'm like, wow, I always thought that too. But I thought that was kind of cool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a place for people to come and learn. So, and I have a lot of different teachers that teach, because believe me, I don't know it all. So I have a lot of teachers that come in and they teach from their expertise. And it's a lot of fun. We have a great time.
So what are some of the classes that you teach there?
I mostly teach psychic development and spirit communication. So I teach people to do what I do. and I teach them, I have a method of how I do it, and it's very simple to the point. And that's usually what I teach. Occasionally I will teach on, personal development, setting, law of attraction, setting goals. I do a lot of life coaching and business coaching as well. So, and that's usually, and I do it all intuitively with the help of, that's how I do my psychic readings. People will say, I don't read minds. I don't read energy. I communicate with spirit guides. I communicate with angels, and I get information about people's lives. So when someone sits in front of me, I will look to see who their guide is, and then I will go right to their guide and say, well, what do you want to talk to them about? And they'll just start blabbing.
Mm.
You know? They'll say, well, you got a pain in your left knee and you need this or that, or, I see that your job is on the line and there's a lady that works at your work that you're having problems with, and they'll just go on, and they'll just start going down their life and guiding them with issues that are going on.
And it sounds like you're able to give them help in things.
I'd like to think so. I've had great feedback.
Great.
Sometimes it's a tattling session, and their guides will tattle on them and say, your health is really bad. You need to lose weight. You need to exercise, and this is what's stopping you. And although my own guides talk to me about that, and I don't listen either. So.
Okay. How many of us don't need to lose weight? Exercise more. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. There are some lucky people out there. They don't have to. I'm married to one of them.
It's that time of year. I love to go for long walks, but it's so cold now and it's all icy. So I say, well, it's dangerous because of all the ice, so I just can't do it right now.
So yeah, that's when a treadmill has to become your friend.
I know. It really needs to.
There's some great walking meditations, I'll tell you. Walking is such an amazing way to meditate. I have no time for meditation at all. And my mind's going too fast. But I can do meditation when I walk, and it's great.
Very few people realize it. I remember reading that one other place, too. Most people think, oh, I should meditate. I know that it's really good for me. And I used to meditate daily for a while, and I found during that time I really enjoyed it, and I found that my mind was sharper. I was able to remember my dreams, and I understood what they meant, which I thought was really neat, because normally I can't even remember what I dream. And then other people would tell me their dreams, and they'd say, well, I don't know what this meant, but... And I'd say, well, that's really obvious. That, this is referring to your dad, and you're worried about this, da-da-da.
Well, I've actually talked to marathon runners that actually meditate during the marathon.
During a marathon? Wow.
And they have to go in a zone, because how could you do it? I would be going crazy by the time I was at the third mile. So they go into a zone.
That is such a good point. I never thought of that, but yeah, that's got to be how most people even get through it. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, usually by mile 12, you're kind of numb. So to make it all those other miles, you just kind of go into a zone, and you almost go on autopilot, and you're literally almost out of your body, focusing. At least that's what they've told, because I have never, ever ran a marathon before.
I still haven't, and I'm not really planning to. But
yeah, I would really have to be astral traveling to manage that. If I can find a way for my body to run the marathon while I go shopping, I will let you know.
That would be good. Marissa, I've got a question up on the message board about whether you've ever done anything with ET contacts.
That's a great question. I could tell you some of my experiences. As a child growing up, I have always, my father used to talk to me about ETs and that he believed in it, and he believed in UFOs, so I kind of grew up always believing in it myself. But at the same time, I am a complete skeptic. I definitely have this. I've got to see it to believe it. And so sometimes I feel kind of goofy talking about ETs, but at the same time, I know what experiences I've had. So one of them was, I have a guide. It's a female guide who I've communicated with for about probably 3.5 years, and all of a sudden one day she appeared to me as a gray. And I just threw me for a loop because I was like, what are you doing? And I had all these different people had been painting soul portraits of me, and they always painted this giant gray behind me. And these were people I didn't even know, and I was like, why do you keep drawing an alien in my pictures? And she appeared, and I started thinking back to some things that, and as a kid, that I kept always seeing this face, and I knew that it was her. And then I had an experience where I had these little people at the foot of my bed when my daughter was very young, and I saw a shadow going back and forth in front of her crib. And then it was like over to my right, there was this little man with this kind of a big head, but he was short. They were very short. They were only like 4 feet tall, was standing there kind of guarding the door. Mm-hmm. And it was very E.T. I mean, absolutely. And I just remember saying to them, you're not allowed to be here. I did not give you permission. And they just said to me, they communicated back to me that they were just observing her because they were fascinated. And they didn't mean to offend me. And it was like the second they said that, they disappeared.
Oh, boy.
And then I had another experience, which I actually have shared with different people because I'm... One day I was coming off the freeway off-ramp by my house, and there was a car turning in front of me, and the man turned around, and he was driving behind the wheel, and he looked at me, and his entire body changed from a human man to a lizard. And he had this smile on his face. It was very creepy. And I felt very negative. I felt like it was very negative energy. I didn't feel anything good from it at all. And I would say that's as close as to ET experiences. Now, I will say this. I was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie back in September. And what was really amazing is once I did that show, many of the readings that I do have had many ETs involved. And it's been quite an eye-opener for me. Because I've done so many readings where I've had spirits of ETs come in and communicate and tell me, and guides that were ETs, and I've seen, you know, past lives for people that were on other planets, and I saw some really interesting things. So,
well, I was wondering, because early on when you were talking about communicating with spirits when you first started, you were describing essentially telepathic communication, and so many people have said that when they communicate with the ETs that it is telepathic.
It is. It, from my experience, it is, absolutely.
Yeah. So, it did make me wonder how you can tell the difference, you know, whether you were getting contacts from both or whether, you know, how difficult is it to tell whether you're getting contact from a human spirit or from something from somewhere else. But there's one thing you just said that really caught my attention, and that's when you talked about people having previous lives on other planets. So it's as if the same soul sometimes has a life on another planet and then sometimes here.
Yes, absolutely. And from what my experience is that ETs have a soul just like we have a soul. And so those souls and spirits can come and communicate with me even if it was a human soul. So it's like the soul can choose to try different lives and go to different places. I believe we are all one, but we can take on many different forms.
I've been hearing a lot of people talking about exactly that, you know, we are all one. And I was talking with Stan Friedman in the first hour of the show, and he was saying he hoped that people could begin to realize that we're all in this together, we're all earthlings, and that we shouldn't be fighting each other, we should be working together to look at what else is out there, elsewhere in the world and off this planet. And so that just takes this whole thing to the next level. Not only is it that we're all earthlings, but even here and on other planets and other galaxies, wherever other dimensions may be, wherever these beings are coming from, we're still all the same. That's fascinating.
It's all love. It's all love. And if it's not love, it's fear. And so most of the negativity towards ETs is completely fear-based because it's a lack of control. It's the fear of the unknown, and so it's just completely fear-based. And it's like I haven't had the privilege of having an ET sit down in my office and say, I'd like to talk to my dead mother. When that happens, then I will know that, you know, then it will be I'm communicating with an ET's, you know, family member that has passed on. But I do have souls that have come to me. I'll be doing a reading on, a gentleman, and I'll have all of a sudden one of the spirits that shows up in my office will be an ET saying, this is my son. This is my son from another life.
And that's got to be a bit of a mind blower right there.
Well, most of those people tended to be listeners from that kind of a industry. I mean, the whole UFO realm. So they were open to it. And it's funny because most of them said, I know. I already know that.
Wow. To come out with something that sounds so amazing and have somebody say, oh, yeah, I know.
Well, believe me, it sounds bizarre coming out of my mouth.
Yeah.
It literally does.
Oh, I know. I mean, I've been to a lot of UFO conferences. I get used to this sort of thing. And the hard thing is when I come home and I go back to work and I talk to the people I work with, you know, they say, well, what did you do last weekend? And so I tell them, you know, it was a UFO conference. And, you know, the eye rolling starts. And
I did a UFO conference in August, and it was really interesting. It was really interesting. And I mean, I would love to see one with my eyes, you know. I always see what I call UFO clouds, and I'm like, there they are. They're hiding in the clouds.
Oh, wow.
So we see them all.
Well, you're going to be speaking next month at the UFO Congress Conference in Laughlin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be there, so I will get to meet you in person. That'll be really fun.
That's great. I'm looking forward to it.
Great.
Yeah, it's going to be a great conference.
I'm looking at the schedule here. You are speaking, when are you speaking?
Friday night.
Friday.
I think it's 4:30 to 6.
Friday afternoon, talking about spirit world experience.
Yeah.
Oh, so more of what we've been talking about this evening.
What I will be doing is actually going through the entire audience and literally giving them validation and messages from the other side.
Oh, wow.
That's what I'll do. And I usually do it. It's sometimes up to like 400 or 500 people, and they're in an audience, and I'm going around the room, and I'm literally giving messages and telling them who's standing there with them and, you know, how they died and what do they look like and where they're from, and that's how I do it.
Wow. And I see in the brochure it says that you may be offering personal reading sessions as well.
I am going to be doing some on Friday and Saturday and possibly Sunday. I'll be doing some private readings. I'm already getting pretty booked up, but I will be offering some of those.
Okay. Wow. Well, I am so looking forward to meeting you, and we are actually just about out of time, and it sounds like my phone is about to cut out on this, too.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be on your show, and I wish you great luck, and I look forward to seeing you next month.
I'm looking forward to it, too, Marissa. Thank you so much for being on Through the Keyhole. I've really enjoyed getting to talk with you.
Okay, great. Have a great night and a great weekend.
You, too.
And stay warm.
And enjoy that temperature is in the 70s for me.
Oh, I'm going to Palm Springs tomorrow. I'll lay out by the pool for you.
Okay. Get a tan for me.
I sure will.
Thanks so much, Marissa.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And thanks so much, everyone, for joining me on Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans. This has just been a lot of fun. I've been starting my UFO Congress speaker series. And I had Stan Friedman on in the first hour for anyone who's coming in late. And my guest for the second hour was Marissa Ryan, who works with the Awareness Institute. And she is the first psychic ever to be invited to the UFO Congress. So this is pretty exciting. If anyone wants more information on the Congress, go to their website at ufocongress.com. I will mention that if you're thinking about going and you haven't registered yet, now is the time to go check out the site, because the early registration deadline is going to be Monday, the 19th. That's the coming Monday, January 19th. If you call on Monday, you can still get the reduced rates for signing up early. You can get an entire week, the entire conference, your hotel room, the speaker party, the banquet at the end of the week, the whole thing for $499 if you call by Monday. Okay, if you wait, the price is going to go up. So be sure to call in. We've got 30 pretty amazing speakers from all over the world, aside from Stan coming in from Canada. We have got A.J. Gavard coming from Brazil. We've got Malcolm Robinson from the U.K. We have got Jaime Musan from Mexico. And I'm doing this off the top of my head from memory, so I'm sure that there are many, many, many more people who are going to be there. Go to UFOCongress.com and download the brochure. You can take a look at the speaker list. You can see the schedule. If you can't be there for the entire week, you can pick out a day that you'd like to attend and just go for one or two days. Definitely come and check it out. It's a pretty amazing conference and lots of fun. Thanks again for joining me, everyone. This has been Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. Stay tuned for Portal coming up next with Tuesday Miles and Angela, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye.